Sehgal is the Director of Legal Services for the Criminal Justice Branch of the British Columbia Ministry of the Attorney General. As well, he is the Crown Counsel Media Spokesperson for the Air India trial. He's on the line with me this morning from Victoria. Please welcome to the commentary.ca, Jeffrey Gall. Good morning, Mr. Gall.
Good morning.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us. First of all, I understand that there are some things that you will not be able to talk about. So lest anyone listening to us infer that you're being unnecessarily evasive or rude, we must remember that due to the highly sensitive nature of prosecution and the sort, we'll have to accept your answers as you provide them.
Thank you.
Before we get into the Air India verdict and the process that's going on with regards to the to whether or not you appeal the decision or not, I want to ask about the Robert Picton case because there were some developments yesterday. There's a lot of talk about from victims' families about the length of time that it's taken for this case to go to trial, just like the Air India case. In terms of the delays, what accounts for them?
Well, I think the first thing you look at is the extent, and the nature and extent of the investigation. Although you cannot draw a parallel between the Picton case and the Air India prosecution, one small similarity is just the magnitude of the work that the police have had to do. In the Picton case, there was an excavation that went underway that resulted in a significant amount of time being spent there and also resulted in a significant amount of material that has needed to be analyzed, scientifically analyzed. So that, right off the top, that's one reason why that we can point to as to why it's taken what some people think is too long to get to where we are. From our perspective, we know, from the prosecution's perspective, we know everyone is anxious to proceed, but we also know that nobody wants us to proceed hastily at the risk of jeopardizing the prosecution. It's a fine balance, but generally speaking, I think the public would prefer that the prosecution proceed cautiously and take their time to ensure that we are ready, as opposed to racing to try and meet an early deadline at the expense of, say, being ready to proceed.
Now, the investigation, is that law enforcement, or is that done in concert with prosecution, or is it just law enforcement?
That's primarily law enforcement. The investigation of any alleged criminal misconduct lies strictly with the police. They decide whether to investigate. They decide how to investigate. They also decide whether they will forward a report to Crown Counsel for charge assessment. Now, we obviously work in concert with the police also. We're not completely distinct, but our authorities, our jurisdictions are distinct. So one way to put it is the Crown cannot direct the police to do an investigation or to do an investigation in a certain way. They decide that. But naturally, there are, during a case, say, of this magnitude, there is ongoing communication as to the state of the investigation, and if there's need for certain types of legal advice, then the Crown can assist.
You're talking to a layman, so if you'll pardon these rather inane questions, but the selection of judges yesterday in the Picton matter, Mr. Justice Jeffrey Barrow was selected. How is the selection of judges done? Is there a certain criteria that a judge has to meet, or is it just whoever's without a trial at the moment?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask the associate chief justice that, or the administration of the court. The prosecution, Crown Counsel, has no say whatsoever in which judge is assigned to which trial and how that decision is made. We don't influence, we don't participate in that decision. We are just told who the judge will be. So how the court administration came about choosing Mr. Justice Barrow is something that that I'm not aware of. He's a respected judge. But why he was chosen or how he was chosen is something that the prosecution isn't involved with, and I don't know why.
Now, I was interested in reading the summary of the judgment of the Air India trial. Why was the Air India and Narita bombings, why were they tried in B.C. and not in Ireland or Japan?
Because on a very straightforward or simple basis, the alleged conspiracy or conspiracies originated in British Columbia. The starting point for these alleged criminal acts was British Columbia. While there were international aspects to the case, or tentacles of the case, the originating location for these crimes was British Columbia.
Would we see a prosecution in Japan, for example, because I believe those were Japanese nationals who were killed at the airport in Narita, right?
Correct. They were, yes. The two individuals who died at the New Tokyo International Airport in Narita were Japanese nationals.
Will they be proceeding with a prosecution, or have they given that up, or do you know anything about that?
I don't know what the Japanese authorities have done or plan on doing, or whether they plan on doing anything. That's beyond the authority or jurisdiction of British Columbia prosecutors. We had the ability to prosecute for those deaths because the originating acts occurred in British Columbia. The bombs, which Mr. Justice Josephson concluded existed, and the conspiracy that he concluded existed also, all originated in British Columbia. The two bombs, one that went east and one that went west, the two tickets that were purchased, the one phone call that was made for those tickets, all originated in British Columbia. That's how we obtained jurisdiction to prosecute these offenses.
Before we get into that, I want to talk about probably one of the more important aspects of the case, and that was working with victims' families. You probably have never had a professional experience like this. Would you talk to me about the extraordinary experience of working with victims' families in this case?
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it, an extraordinary experience. There never has been a prosecution like this in Canada before, and I say that from a number of angles. Leaving aside the evidentiary challenges and as I say, the nature of the offenses, the horrific nature of the offenses, then you look at the impact of these offenses on 331 families, so to speak, or the families of 331 people. So yes, there was a need to address the victims' requirements, and the British Columbia prosecution of the Crown Council here in British Columbia, we were able to work with the federal authorities to obtain funding for a victim services program. So while the funding originated from the federal government, we administered the program, and that allowed us to provide a significant level of service to the families of the victims of Flight 182. And those services were also offered to the victims of the Narita bombing. And that allowed, for example, victims' family members to attend for 1 week of the trial so that they could observe and get a better sense of what was going on. And their travel expenses and accommodations were paid for. There was also a joint venture, so to speak, between the federal government and the Crown Council office here in BC and the victims' families themselves to create a remembrance book, which is a compilation of biographies and pictures of those who perished on Flight 182. So significant efforts were made to accommodate the needs of the victims' families of these acts, and I think to a great extent we were quite successful in doing so.
There was a great deal of money spent building the state-of-the-art courtroom, and I assume there were pressures on all sides of the defense and the Crown with regards to security. How big a concern was security in this trial?
Well, given the allegations, we were talking allegations of terrorism, so right off the bat there's obviously going to be some security issues, but they fell to be addressed by three parties, so to speak. Within the confines of the courthouse, we have the sheriff's services. They're the authorities when it comes to security of the courtroom and security of the courthouse. Outside of the premises, on the street outside the courthouse, we also had the Vancouver police, and we had the RCMP. That was their domain, so to speak. So while the prosecution focused on getting the evidence prepared and presented in the court, we were quite confident and comfortable with those three authorities, the sheriffs, the Vancouver police, and the RCMP, in how they addressed and handled security matters and any security issues that came up.
When the verdict was brought down on the 16th of March, it was said that the Crown had 30 days to review it and consider an appeal. Is that 30-day rule a standard in all trials?
Yes.
And in this case, the judgment is rather long. Will you be able to ask for an extension?
Premature to say that. What we can do is that, and the rules allow for this, is that if you miss a deadline, say inadvertently, by accident, you miss a deadline, you can go to the court and ask for the deadline to be extended, explaining why you missed it. Now, in this case, we are fully cognizant and aware of our deadline. Whether we will need to ask for an extension of that deadline is something, frankly, we'll have to wait and see. We are working as we speak right now. We have a team of appellate counsel who are experienced in appellate matters, reviewing the judgment to determine whether we should proceed with an appeal or not.
And is that 30-day rule, is that extended to the defense as well if the case went the other way around?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. These are rules of court, so it's not unique to one party or the other.
What's the criteria for appealing a decision? I mean, if you just disagree with it, appeal it, or I'm sure you'd have to meet a certain threshold, right?
You're right, and that's a very good and it's an important question to explain, because a party may not like a decision; they might think the decision is wrong. But you have to find legal grounds to appeal a decision. So simply because one party might not agree with it or like it, that doesn't give you the grounds. Moreover, the trial judge is entitled to make findings of fact, such as, I don't find witness A credible. I don't accept the evidence of witness B. That's the role of a judge. The trial judge makes those decisions. For an appeal, the Crown needs to find errors in law where the court, say, misapplied the law and therefore fell into error. And that would be called an error in law as opposed to an error in fact. Errors in law are appealable. Errors in fact are not.
So there was a lot of talk in the judgment, I read just the summary, about witnesses not being credible. That would be difficult to appeal, would it?
Very challenging, but what we do look at is we look at the entire judgment as a whole. So it's not a matter of cherry-picking individual pieces or individual decisions. What might, from one perspective, seem to be an error of fact, might in fact, if you look at the entire judgment, have an aspect of law to it, an error in law. It is an exceptionally complex procedure or process to review a judgment to find a grounds for an appeal, and it's very difficult to explain in a short clip, so to speak. But as best we can say is that you can't appeal just because you don't like a decision. You can't appeal because you disagree with the judge's findings of fact. The judge has to have made an error in the law to allow for an appeal. And that just allows for the appeal. The next step is, is the error so egregious that the Court of Appeal will overturn the judgment and order a new trial? Because the Court of Appeal might very well say, yes, there's an error, but it's such a minor error, or the error did not have a significant impact on the judgment, that we don't find it warrants an overturning of the decision. So it's quite possible that a party launches an appeal and is successful, and the court says, yes, I find there's an error in law, but it's not significant enough to overturn the judgment, so you don't end up with a new trial.
Who hears the appeal? Is that the BC Court of Appeal, or is that Mr. Justice Josephson?
It is the Court of Appeal. So now it would move from the British Columbia Supreme Court, the Superior Trial Court of British Columbia. It would move to the Appellate Court of British Columbia, the BC Court of Appeal.
And then, conceivably, could it go higher to the Supreme Court of Canada?
Conceivably, yes.
Suppose the appeal goes to the BC Court of Appeal hears the appeal, and they can go one way or the other, right? They can say no, or they can order a retrial, right?
Correct.
In terms of the retrial, is that a completely new trial, or do you guys just file briefs and on the points of contention, and then the judge will make his decision, or do you actually have to go through it again?
It's a completely new trial. It's a retrial from square one. So calling the evidence again, it doesn't mean that the parties would not reach admissions of fact, which we did in the first trial. But there's no guarantee that those admissions would be made, just as there's no guarantee you'd have the same lawyers. So you're back to square one, which raises the third important consideration when you look at a potential appeal. It's one thing to find an error in law. It's one thing to find an error in law that is significant enough that the Court of Appeal would overturn a judgment. The third issue is, even if the judgment is overturned, do we believe that with that decision of a new trial, are we able to marshal the evidence once again? Because if there is no such belief, it raises the question, then why appeal? If a prosecution, and I'm stepping out of the Air India case just generally, if the party does not believe that we're able to remarshal an evidence and retry the matter, that influences, that's a big influence on whether we proceed with the trial or not. Proceed with an appeal or not.
How do you respond to people, and I'm asking you as a prosecutor in general, to people who after this trial, not only this, but other stories that we read about in the media, other decisions, other court cases, who are weary of the criminal justice system, who don't believe that justice is served, who are increasingly fed up with some of the judgments that come from our judges and you know, who don't like the decisions that are made, and who are perhaps skeptical that they won't be treated fairly should they ever enter the system as a victim or an accused?
Well, I've read the concerns and criticism, and I've heard it through the media also. But from my perspective as a prosecutor, that there is confidence in the judicial system, in our criminal justice system. It may not provide the results that people want, but it is a fair and impartial and professional system. It is a system that's designed to have errors addressed in the sense of appeals. It allows for appeals. It's also a system that's irrespective of the nature of the alleged offense, whether you're talking about theft of a chocolate bar or mass murder of 331 people. The standard of proof is still the same. The burden of proof is still the same. It's on the Crown. The Crown has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't change. And frankly, I think people should take confidence from that just because a case is horrific or the impact of a case is huge, it doesn't alter the rules one iota. So people know that, frankly, whether you're charged with theft or whether you're charged with murder, you're going to have a fair trial within the system. And that the rules don't change to benefit either of the parties.
Obviously, the families in the Air India case have been disappointed with the decision. And regardless if the Crown appeals or if they do not, there's still the unresolved nature of their loss. If the trial goes to an appeal and there's a retrial, they'd have to relive this whole experience over again. How do you, as a prosecutor, comfort families, especially victims' families, in a case like this or any other case?
Well, to a great extent, I think the families comfort themselves. Over the years, and everyone recognizes that it has taken a significant amount of time to get to where we got to, but the families have developed amongst themselves to a certain degree a support group and a communications channel that I think has provided them with some level of comfort. Within the criminal justice system, there aren't always all the answers. But if we do, and it makes no difference whether it's this trial or any other trial, we try to be sensitive to the impact of crimes on victims, and we try to be aware of their needs. But at the end of the day, as prosecutors, our role is very specific. And while we're not the lawyers of the victims. We are not the counsel for the victims. We try to be sensitive to their needs. Our role is to marshal the evidence and to get it into court, and naturally to advocate a position based upon our view of the evidence. But moving directly to the Air India case, I think we've done all we can in conjunction with the federal government and the families themselves. I point to the remembrance book that was created, and it sure would not have been created without the assistance and, in fact, the initiative of a lot of the family members. We wouldn't have got the pictures or the biographies unless the families were prepared to participate. And that book in itself, which has been given out to the families, I think is a small gesture to assist them in getting some sense of closure from these proceedings.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for talking with us today. I know that you're very busy, and I really appreciate it, and I found it fascinating, and I'm sure my audience finds it fascinating as well.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Jeffrey Gall, the Director of Legal Services for the Criminal Justice Branch of the Ministry of the Attorney General in British Columbia, and the media spokesperson for Crown Counsel in the Air India trial. He's been my guest here on the commentary.